Hello, this is The Leg Show. We're going to get started in just a couple minutes here. In the meantime, if you have IRC access, be sure to join us at irc.thelinuxshow.com and channel Problem Linux Show. So hang in there. We'll get started right after these messages.
You're listening to The Linux Show. Or maybe you're thinking about it. I don't know. This is probably a commercial. You want to find out about Linux and open source? Check us out at www.linuxshow.com for the best in Linux community news. Check us out.
This is The Linux Show for December the 7th, 2002, bringing you our second to last show.
Ooh.
For 2002. Mm-hmm. We will be back, of course, next year. Can you just imagine that for a moment? Let's put that in perspective, that in another couple of weeks, we will be starting our sixth year of broadcasting. It still amazes me when I think of that.
Wow.
That,
you've lasted longer than the average restaurant. Actually, it's been a lot longer, because I think a 1 in 5 chance that any restaurant will last 5 years,
yeah.
Something like that. Yeah.
Well, I tell you, I think, Doc, I've lasted longer, I should say Kevin and I have lasted longer doing this than probably 80% of the Linux vendors out there as well.
Oh, that's for sure. That's for sure.
So,
yeah.
It's... They're
neutrinos that had more life than us.
Yeah, can't blame it on Linux, though. It's been tough on the whole IT biz. So, but let's get the show kicked off. Arnie's not in here yet. He should be joining us soon. But it's glad to have you back, Doc. Last week, you were at a party.
I was at a party. Actually, yesterday, I almost drove up to San Francisco for the Creative Commons launch. I think actually I was in San Francisco for another party last week. I don't even remember what it was. I'm sure it mattered. But the weather was so bad that I decided I would not be able to make it in less than 8 hours, so I bailed on it, which is too bad. But it would have been great. I understand it was a good party. I haven't heard too much more about it other than it was really nice. But the weather was pretty bad at least for San Francisco. You know, they think if it's windy and rainy that it's horrible. But they don't know. They don't really don't know.
Yeah, you guys just don't know.
They don't know.
People in California have no clue.
No.
Even when you go up to the mountains, just, you know, for a few hours, and so it's long enough to get your sweaters damp, and you come back down.
Yeah, when you discover some interesting things in the mountains. I went up there after a couple of really big snowstorms to ski at a place called Kirkwood, and most people don't know that what sucked in the Donner Party is that there are places in the Sierra that get between 13 and 70 feet of snow. And there was a snowstorm that dumped like 13 feet of snow on out there. It's very interesting what 13 feet of snow will do to a car. If it's not in the garage, it is literally like flattened or close to it. I mean,
gosh.
It was really weird because you pull into the parking lot and it's like all the snow having been cleared, and then there are these like columns with a car at the bottom and a column of snow on top. And the car is like, the metal of the car is on the ground and it's like wrapped around the tires. Really, and there must have been 20 or 30 cars in a lot like that. They just like kind of adapted around them. And obviously those are people who didn't know how it worked. Like, if you're going to want to keep your car, you want to get it out of here before the snow gets deep. So then the cars did not eat each other, though. That would have been more in like what you'd have with more in line with the Donner experience.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, that would be more in line. Very spooky. I just can't imagine that.
Yeah, it's a sight. It's really weird. Really, really weird.
Yep. And how are you doing tonight, Russ?
Oh, I'm hanging in. I didn't quite have the 13-foot snows there that Doc was talking about, but out this way we had ice storms last week, which caused us to lose power for 36 hours. I was without an internet connection for close to 3 days. It was not fun. It was not fun. And in fact, you know, it was kind of interesting because the ice that was clinging to the trees was a lot less than I remember back in my days in Connecticut and New York. But my assumption is that it happens so rarely here that any marginal tree branch that hadn't been touched in years came down as a result of this. So there were tree limbs all over the place, power lines down all over the place. In fact, there was a while when my son and I were just sort of hanging out inside the dining room listening to the whoosh sounds as various tree limbs were coming down every few minutes in the backyard. It was very, very strange.
Wow.
And we learned a lot about alternative fuels because we're in an all-electric house. And losing power is a major event for us because that means losing heat and everything else. And
well, between the ice and the snow we get in the winter and the tornadoes we get the other three seasons of the year, any cheap or faulty power line was gone 20 years ago.
Yeah, and I was in North Carolina for the biggest ice storm they ever had, bigger than the one that just happened. And in 1996, I think, it was 66, I think it was. And it was an amazing thing to listen to giant oak trees being torn apart by, there was up to 2 inches of ice on everything. You couldn't walk outside. Everything was coated in thick ice.
Yep.
And nobody was going anywhere. It was really incredible. Absolutely amazing.
Yep. It breeds a healthy breed of tree, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Survival of the fittest. So, well, Kevin and I are, as usual, here in Chicago, broadcasting our regular weekly edition. This is a regular show. Next week, we're going to be doing a special show. I've been started the process, I should say, of contacting our various compadres across the Linux community of giving us what their favorite news item was for calendar year 2002. And so next week on Tuesday, the 23rd, we're going to have a much larger panel than we're normally accustomed to. There's going to be about 8 to 10 people off and on during the course of the show. But for tonight, we're going to go ahead and do our regular thing, and hopefully Arnie will hook up with us shortly. But we'll go ahead and jump in with the hot news of the week. And Russ, why don't I go to you, because I know you have a bunch that you sent us links to on. So why don't you go ahead and take it away?
Well, the hottest one is, of course, well, I'll let other people spiel, because I got so many of these other little ones to deal with, but Elcomsoft. I mean, that's...
big news.
That's huge. This is really huge.
Huge. Monstrous news. Monstrous news. For those who haven't heard it, the verdict came back, and it was not guilty on all counts, and that is absolutely amazing. I was reading some of the... at least some of the legal commentary that was inside some of the internet news reports, and you know, there was one guy saying, "Well, you know, if these juries are free to interpret the law and figure out whether or not the defendants are really wanted to do something bad or just instead of enforcing the law as written, then, you know, this law's got a problem." But then again, I look and I see other commentaries saying that the judge gave the jury the instruction that they must determine whether or not the corporation meant to circumvent copyright protection, really meant to go against the DMCA.
Yep. Yeah, it's one of those very gray kind of judgmental things based upon the state of mind of a corporation, and that's a real iffy thing to prove. And frankly, I think that as soon as he set that as an instruction to the jury, do you really think that they could come back with any other decision? I mean, how can you prove the state of mind of an entire company?
Yeah. That is absolutely... It's wild, though. It's a whole wild thing. I really didn't expect to see this at all.
Russ, people are asking me to tell you to talk up, please.
Oh, here we go again. All right. Okay. I've boosted my mic a little bit. But well, I don't know if anyone else have any comments on that before I.
Well, I have too, but let's you know, talk about this, because this, without doubt, is the big story of the month,
right?
If not the quarter, and for sure, this is now going to start some precedent building, and it has to start some precedent building in terms of an impetus for people in Washington to relook at the law sooner rather than later. I mean, there's a lot of discomfort with DMCA in Washington already, and this is going to really, it has to bring it to, you know, the front of the lineup, or, you know, closer to the front of the lineup. And so that's one of the things I think is fortunate of the ruling. The other thing is that I don't know if Dimitri has a legal leg to stand on, so to speak, but it would be interesting to find out if he would be eligible for a civil action against both the prosecutor as well as the all the other parties involved, to see if he could recover money for the losses that he incurred, you know, not only, you know, spending time in jail, but he had to fly back and forth between the United States a couple of times to fight this battle. And it'd be interesting to see if he can find a lawyer that will, you know, pick up this case for him. Because I think should a lawyer pick that up, the, you know, a civil action, it's going to really, for all intents and purposes, put a real crimp in any company nudging a prosecutor to use the criminal aspect of the law as opposed to the civil aspect of the law. And because it was just unconscionable for them to exercise the criminal portion of that law against Dimitri. It was just a crock. And so it would be interesting to see if they can get somewhere with that.
And speaking of which, the party I was at last week was the EFF party, and Dimitri was there. You could tell by the hat. He had his Russian hat on. Having a good time, I might add. There's a lot of stuff on the on this on the. I'm just looking around on Lisa Rhine, who works for the EFF, has had a weblog that's been following the Alcansoff case. If you look up Lisa Rhine, R-E-I-N, on Google, you'll I'm sure you'll find it. And she's been doing a real good job with that. Yeah, Donna Wentworth, who has a news service called Corante, Corante, and she's the legal eagle there, a weblog called Copy Fight, and she's sort of on that case too. A lot of good stuff, a lot of good links there.
Hmm. Was there much excitement at that EFF party last week in terms of the anticipation of the judgment?
Actually, there is excitement sort of in general. To sort of give you the tone of it, John Perry Barlow, who was one of the two founders with Mitch Kapoor of the EFF, stood up and said, you know, he said that the most rousing thing he could say was just to read off the names of all the enemies. So he just went down Jack Valenti, Hillary Rosen, yada yada and yada, and you know, got rounds of applause. There is a sense, I think, of a tide turning, and I'm not even sure why, but there was, at least from the people I talked to, a kind of a sense of optimism about, you know, about where things are going. But, you know, I think between the carp madness and the growing realization that the DMCA was a bad idea and in its own way was just as bad an idea as the Decency Act and a bunch of other things like that. I think it's dawning on a lot of Congress people that the Hollywood connection is not what they used to think it was. I don't know. I'm just sensing that. And there was sort of a little bit of that feel to it. But we'll see. I don't know. There was kind of guarded optimism about a bunch of different cases.
Well, I will agree with you on there is definitely a growing anticipation that I am feeling everywhere I go. Literally everywhere I go, all the groups I talk to, the groups of educators that I've been speaking before, there is, during the last few months, a change in the air. And I've been, for the last couple months, saying, I honestly think, and I people have said it before, that 2003 is going to be, the breakout year for Linux on the desktop, and a lot of the hesitance towards that during the course of the last, month and a half, was all the negative press, at least negative in terms of the perception of it by the open source community of what has been going on in India during the course of the last couple months with Linux making major strides within India, and then all of a sudden on the heels of India's largest open source conference comes Bill Gates with his $500 million spending spree.
Mm-hmm.
And if you listen to the shows from a month and a half ago, a lot of the stories that we were talking about were, oh damn it, here they go again. Microsoft is using, monopoly monies to buy another market. But the good news is, the people from India aren't buying it. They are. Whatever you want to say, combination of both too poor and they're too smart to fall for the PR stunt that Gates tried to pull. And all of a sudden I'm getting emails from people in India or some of the surrounding countries, Japan and Australia, referencing news stories in the local India press about how Gates really did piss off a lot of people when he went to that country. Yeah. And how that after they've had the time to look at the potential impact of the gift that he has waved under their noses, that although they have every intention on accepting whatever gifts they can that have no strings on them, it would be a disaster for their entire country to accept any financial gift based upon guarantees to Microsoft that India is going to become a Microsoft OS country, because they just, plain and simple, can't afford it. They don't. Their people don't have the money to afford new computers, much less $129 Windows XP licenses. And so, lo and behold, during the course of the last week, there's been a couple of Linux desktop systems introduced in India, and they're selling like hotcakes. They are doing very, very well. I've contacted a couple of people in India to try and actually get me some firm numbers on how well they're selling. But it looks like there is a, if not full scale, a definite noticeable revolt against Bill Gates' PR PR campaign from a couple weeks ago. So that's one of my big stories of the week, is that kudos to the Indians that they didn't buy it. So,
yeah.
Russ, have you got another story, or Doc? Go ahead and jump in too.
Just as an angle on that, we had an editorial meeting today, and Phil, or one of the guys, was saying that the word is that while a lot of people here are outsourcing to India, India's outsourcing to China. It's not exactly a Linux story, but it's an interesting thing.
Yep.
But there's the larger story, and this is one that I'm very interested in following. I mean, there's so many different ways of going at it. Linux is succeeding all over the place, and there is not a single company that has an interest in letting everybody know exactly how total this thing is. I mean, even IBM and HP. What I witnessed at Comdex, I think I may have mentioned this on the show. If I didn't, forgive me for repeating it. But I was amazed that Carly Fiorina stood up in front of 5,000 people and talked for an hour in what amounted to an infomercial, mentioning Linux just coincidentally at the end of a roster of operating systems they supported. Three times. The only time she actually said something flattering was to say that Spirit of the Cimarron, or whatever that animated feature was done with Linux. Yet, and then at the end of it, she sent an instant message on her tablet PC to Steve Ballmer, who was sitting in the audience, and you could almost see the puppet strings going up there. I mean, it was really, it was a Microsoft show anyway, but. But now the advertising's coming out, and big spreads going on, and they're all, and I think like half the pages that HP is buying mention Linux on them.
Yeah,
you know, they have no choice; they have to use it. You know, it's free building material, and it's better than the stuff you pay for. End of story. You know, carry on. And yet they don't want to talk about it, and that's because of the PC side of things. They're still being held by the short hairs by Microsoft on PCs. You know, I mean, as the Toshiba guy said when I asked him, you know, I just played dumb. I was wearing my AOTC badge, not my Linux Journal badge. I went up and I said, I'm interested in a Linux laptop. And he looked at me like I just asked him for a plate of shit and said, we don't do that. Really, it's incredible. I mean, we don't do that. You know, and all the laptops say, in fact, all the desktops as well that were there, and the entire floor for every manufacturer said designed for Windows XP, right? Along with the little Intel inside, or, you know, some cases not. I mean, it's interesting. I mean, you know, Microsoft can buy Comdex, and they can lay $500 million on India, and it's not going to make a difference. You can't compete with free. I'm sorry, and you can't. They're going to have to find something else, you know, another way to do that. And it's a matter of time before some of the big players, a Dell or somebody, is going to just come out with a Linux laptop, and it's going to sell like hell.
Well,
it's going to happen. It has to happen.
Well,
at some point, they make that move.
Well, it's obvious, Doc, that they're already feeling it because they're having their lunch handed to them by Microtel and Walmart, selling 7,000 Linux PCs a month.
Where do you have those numbers?
From Walmart.
From Walmart?
Yeah.
Wow. If you could email me that, some hard stuff, of course I could probably quote that.
Well, you can quote me, but I've been trying to get a firm written quote from Walmart for the last month and a half. They keep on telling me the high single-digit thousands.
Really?
Okay, they don't have exact totals, but they say it's the high single-digit thousands.
Because I spent some time in context with the Microtech guys, a Microtech guy, I should say, who said that it's not being sold at any of the stores yet. Now, I heard today that Lindos is going retail in some way, whatever that means.
It's in boxes.
Yeah,
it's boxes.
Boxes.
Okay. But he said that the largest number being sold were Lindos, but Mandrake was not too far behind that at this point. But it's interesting. He did say, you know, that they sell a bunch. You know, they sell a bunch. They're sort of like, you know, the most generic PC maker there is. They played with one. Okay, you know.
Yeah, they're right up there with the other leading white boxes. But the Carly woman from HP, who back in September I ranted a couple of tirades at her. Hi, Arnie. I guess that's not Arnie. That must be our guest for the next segment calling in. But she literally embarrassed herself during that GeoForum, saying that HP would never, in the foreseeable future, we're never going to come out with a Linux desktop. There's just not the numbers. And when somebody in the audience stood up and told her that the early numbers from Walmart, and that was, of course, back in September, is that they're selling 3,000 to 4,000 a month at that time frame,
mm-hmm.
That completely caught the HP people completely off guard. They did not know how to respond to that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I think you're right that they can't argue with the inevitability of it all, and they've got to start doing some advertising, doing the Me Too, or they're going to become just completely irrelevant in the market.
Yeah. They will. You know, inevitably they will. It's just a matter of the molecules organize. You know, enough molecules start pointing north, and all of a sudden it gets magnetic. You know, they suddenly realize it's there. But you know, the big companies are often the last to sort of like, you know, get with the plan. But you know, it's inevitable.
Yeah. Got any other stories this week, Doc?
God, I just had one, and I lost it.
Well, you think about it.
You go to the other guys. I'll think of it in a second.
We'll turn it over to Kevin, and then go back to Russ.
Because sometimes you have two screens open at the same time, and you go back and forth. And like I managed to have 80 windows open, and they're all, you know. Anyway.
But Kevin, have we got any new releases this week?
Oh yeah, a couple of interesting notes. Mozilla 1.3 Alpha is out, and this is the first edition with the so-called Bayesian method of spam filtering integrated into it, which if you played around with BogoFilter or any of the other programs, seems to be a pretty effective way of filtering spam. And it should also have GTK2 support, although I haven't actually tested out the latest RPMs to see if it's in there yet or not. And on another note, NVIDIA has integrated their Linux and FreeBSD drivers into their universal driver development, so...
Yeah, that is a big deal.
From now on, they should be completely up-to-date with the Windows drivers, and they're actually offering Linux tech support.
That's really cool, because they were hard to set up back a year or so ago. Very difficult. Any more?
That's the big one.
I'll throw it out and then jump it back over to Russ. I'm sure you've all heard... In the past 24 hours, it's been all over the place, and I have been madly emailing off to Jabber all day long trying to get a response.
Oh, I haven't been able to raise anything either, I think. Yeah, but go ahead and you talk about it.
Okay, the big news of AOL being granted one of these goofy patents to protect instant messaging. But the way the reporting on this patent sort of reads is this patent would include IRC.
Yeah.
Because it basically says any form of communication where you can see a list of users that are online.
You know, the one of the things that came to my mind when I read that description was the old VAX phone utility.
Yeah,
which dates back into the well into the 80s, early 80s.
Yeah,
and that was far from unique at the time. I mean, that there were tons of other things. I remember as an undergrad, for crying out loud, there was a thing over at Dartmouth that used to be very similar to that too. It just seems ludicrous, the whole patent on this.
Well, I think the fact that IRC has existed as long as it has is going to make this patent totally unenforceable.
We can only hope.
Yeah, we can only hope. But we'll see. We'll see. But if possible, not for next week's show, but if, Doc, if you can get a word at the Jabber guys, maybe get them on the show in a couple of weeks.
Yeah.
Sometime immediately after January 1st, to give them a couple of weeks to have their lawyers digest the impact of that patent, because for them, this is really serious. It could really spell doom to companies like Jabber. So.
I doubt it would, actually. I think it's not, they're not against Microsoft on this, among other people. They're not going to be able to do anything with it.
Yeah, that's true. Microsoft would be the first company to line up in that legal battle against AOL. They really would. So, strange bedfellows time to time. Russ, any more stories this week?
Yeah, just a few quickies from the Linux Show webpage. In fact, it was even mentioned in IRC earlier. Windows and .NET Magazine actually has a very interesting little story called What You Need to Know About Linux, that aside from one thing saying that Windows scales better than Linux, I'm not quite sure how they come up with that, is actually a pretty well-written article. They actually have no venom that I could detect through a fast reading. And they got more or less their facts in order, so it's kind of interesting to see that in a Windows publication.
Yep, that is interesting. Well, I have one more quickie before we jump into the break, and this is and I told you so. A lot of people were poo-pooing me after the first quarter of this year when I was reading Red Hat's first quarter report. And there was a lot of good news back at the time of the first quarter of their present fiscal year. And they have just today released their financials for third quarter of the fiscal year. And unless something utterly disastrous happens in the next month and a half, it looks like Red Hat has finally made their target for profitability.
Right, yeah.
And that is kudos to Red Hat. I mean, they were saying back in May, toward the end of the first quarter of their fiscal year, that they were going to hit profitability this year, and it really, a lot of people didn't believe it. I mean, the numbers really did indicate that they were there in terms of the contracts that they had in hand at that time. But, boy, big kudos and congratulations. They actually made a profit or look like they're on target. Presuming they don't lose any of these contracts in the interim, they're on target to actually make a $305,000 net profit on $24 million, I think it was, in actual sales. And so... finally, they get the opportunity to write off some of those losses over the last couple of years and recoup some of the owner's equity. Big good news. What I'd like to just throw out there to the whole group and just sort of like express an opinion, and it would be interesting to hear this from Red Hat, is how come... An open source company, or at least a mostly open source company, has been profitable in 2002 when most IT companies have lost their ass. This is really, truly remarkable. Because maybe, and I'm sort of speaking facetiously here, maybe the model works after all, the open source model. Works after all, and that the things that we've been saying year after year, that this really does work, and that Red Hat finally got a really good solid grasp on how to make that model work. Really pleased to see this actually happening to somebody other than IBM making a lot of money on Linux.
You know, frankly, one of the things that I think we may discover in the next year is that the business models that some of the early Linux firms adopted and then dropped may well become workable in this next year. And that's because they had a lot of good ideas, but they had no volume. You know, there wasn't enough business or businesses turning to Linux and open source back in 2000. But in 2003, a lot of these support-based business models, I think, will suddenly have enough customers to actually work for a change.
Yeah.
You know, we saw LinuxCare, we saw some of these other ones that seemed to have a good idea at the time, but they couldn't make a go of it.
Yeah. Well, I think you're right. Obviously, there's a few people out there doing things correctly and profitably. Tell you, I almost drove off the side of the road today. I heard for the first time ever on the radio in Chicago a commercial for a local Linux vendor advertising on radio.
Wow. And
a company by the name of linuxbox.nu or some strange TLD that I had never heard before and haven't had a chance to really check them out yet, but they're a manufacturer, or apparently a manufacturer of small appliance-style servers servicing only the Chicago market. That's what the advertisement said. And so I think perhaps you're right. I think the critical mass is there. Finally. Well, let's take a short break. It is, after all, 40 after the hour. We've gone a few minutes long. And we will come back and jump into segment number two, bring in our guest, and take a few minutes to discuss adaptive firewalls. It's not the first time we've discussed this type of technology. It's really sort of cool. People remember back about a year and a half ago, we had a guest talking about this, and we actually had a hacker challenge that night where we they set up one of their servers and were offering extremely large amount of money. I can't remember what it was at the time, but it was like $10,000 if people could hack into the server during the show. But very interesting topic. So everybody, sit back, relax. Kevin, put on a tune, and we'll be right back with segment number two of the Linux Show for December 17th, 2002.
I'd like to take this opportunity to thank the sponsors who make the Linux Show possible. I'd like to thank VA Linux. Oops, no, they're not VA Linux anymore. They are now VA Software. Hope they don't change their name again pretty soon. I'm going to have to make another commercial. But check out VA Software and learn all about the SourceForge development platform for internal company development projects. Or if you're just a little guy but want to get a flavor of it all, check out SourceForge.net and spread the word on open source development platforms.
I'm
And this is segment number two of the Linux Show for December 17th, 2002. If I'm clicking in and out, I'm having a little trouble with my phone this evening, so you'll just have to bear with me, everybody. We have, as our guest this evening for segment number two, a gentleman who's going to not only talk about adaptive firewalls, as I have now been told, but the book that I referenced in the story or the description of tonight's show. Okay, quick, Jeff, get the name of the book. Okay, Real World Linux Security. We're going to talk about that as well tonight. Our guest is Bob Toxin of Fly By Day Consulting. Is that, did I get that much correct, Bob?
You got everything 100%.
Okay. Well, I'm gonna go ahead and turn this segment over to Russ, and I'm gonna throw my questions in as you work through, because Russ has really been in contact with you and been discussing the book. So, go ahead, Russ. You take right over.
All righty. Good to have you with us tonight, Bob.
Pleasure to be here.
Yeah, I couldn't help but notice by your rather impressive write up over at realworldlinuxsecurity.com, which is a mouthful, about you being one of the 162 developers of Berkeley Unix and 26 years of Unix experience. So I gather you're a real novice when it comes to all this stuff, eh?
Well, I thought I knew all about security until I started writing about the book and it showed me more than anything else. I learned what I actually did know, and I learned, I think, more in that, you know, the period of writing the two editions than I really learned in the previous 26 years or so.
Well, there's a lot of books on Linux security out there and Unix security. Why another one? What was your motivation about doing this particular book, pray tell?
Well, Linux and Unix can be made wonderfully secure if somebody knows how. But I really didn't see any good books out there on how to do that. Certainly nothing for the modern Internet, which didn't exist when some of the earlier books were written. So I saw my biggest contribution to open source, if I could, to write the book on how to do that. And I know that's rather egotistical. I think I might have succeeded, at least in one of the, you know, few top books. One thing I wanted to do was make it a step-by-step book, because nobody can just sit down at their desk and in a day secure their system, not if it's a complex system and not if they need to have it be very secure. So, you know, you can do it step-by-step, and it's, you know, it uses a workbook. You use a little bit, you know, at a time. Or you can use a reference. Okay, I'm going to go and, you know, build a mail server, even though I have other servers going. What I have to worry about in particular about mail. So you just pop it up, open to the index, look under mail, and it go to that section and do what you need to do. And lastly, like probably most of the people reading or listening to the show, our bookshelf of books that I really should read, but they're just frankly too darn dull. So I try real hard to put a lot of humor in there. You know, most of us loving science fiction and all, there's all kinds of references in there that most folks will enjoy, I think.
Okay. So what sort of things are currently plaguing, especially like the home user today? Are there particular hot spots that should be attacked first?
depends which side of the fence you're talking about attacks. Really, a lot of people have no idea about security and really don't make much effort to secure their systems. It's amazing how many people, whether they're home users or even, you know, businesses, will just, you know, pull out their Red Hat or Mandrake or CISA or Slackware CDs and install it. And, well, yeah, I guess mail's working and our web server's working and, you know, I guess we're all set. And, you know, they come back a week later or sometimes the next morning and they've been, you know, taken over just because they've never really worried about it.
Hmm. Have you identified what are the biggest threat areas, the perhaps the most overlooked areas inside securing a system?
Definitely, and I highlight that in a section I call the seven deadly sins of Linux security. And these are the seven things, if you know, you indulge in those sins, your system's almost certainly to get broken into in the next few months.
Can you give us a taste of a couple of these?
Absolutely. First one, which a lot of people, it's not really their fault, is running all kinds of services they don't need. Even say a, you know, Red Hat 7.3 system, or I just dealt with somebody that had a 2.0 system.
Huh?
You know, by default, and so all kinds of services that somebody doesn't want, doesn't use, and yet have a history of severe security problems. NFS, I think, heading the list. You know, DNS.
Anyways,
you know, even an Apache web server. Things where you know, if you don't need it, you might as well turn it off. So that way, that's not in a possible door into your system.
And
sponsor. That's one. The other thing, which almost everybody is guilty of, is just not keeping up security patches. I mean, there was a patch that came out yesterday on SSH that, you know, can be used to attack either a server or the client proxy. And I guess most of the folks listening are running SSH, and I don't know how many of them have installed that patch, unless it's just happening, it's been installed automatically, if they're running, you know, Red Hat's up to date or a CISO utility.
Yeah, that is one of the, I guess in talking to some people, one of the things that I've done to others is that a lot of people aren't taking advantage of some of the mailing lists that some of the distributors have. They publish security patches for people to get emails about that. And yet, it seems like very few people are actually signing up for any of those services. And like I said, security being such a huge concern for the last year, especially with all the international applications in particular. Everyone is talking about how to get your data, and yet it seems like a lot of people are facing that. Now, I know that your book was just published in second edition.
Mm-hmm.
What things have changed in terms of the aspects of security since your first edition? First edition was 2 years ago.
That's correct. Almost exactly 2 years ago.
And what sort of problems have appeared on the radar that maybe one of the inside that first edition?
Well, I think that, you know, the first wave of problems have been taken care of. In other words, back in the 2 years ago, you know, a lot of the programs that came with Linux, there were a significant number of security problems with them. I mean, it seems that, you know, NameD and Threadmail, not to pick on those, but, you know, they seem to have quite a few problems. NFS did. And really, those are folks that maintain those packages. To really spend quite a bit of effort in auditing the code and hardening them. So that is less of a problem now. So the crackers go to the second, you know, level of problem. Certainly, you know, there are a lot of attacks in lower levels now. You know, attacking against protocols and trying to get sequence numbers. Working parties breaking into one system or network, and then from there they can go and attack other systems.
Perhaps an unfair question, but do you foresee any new problems coming on the horizon, say, with the, you know, all works out the third edition a couple of years from now? Can you sense any particular areas that are going to be more vulnerable than they are today, or perhaps more exploited than they are today?
I think certainly the crackers really haven't tried too hard to exploit mail viruses in web browser attacks on Linux. They seem to mostly content with Windows. And the other very disturbing trend I see is everybody and the brother seems to be putting up their wireless network and not really thinking about security at all. Those that I even ask about, oh, well, you know, we're running wireless privacy or running Nexus or any server protected, when in fact neither one of those, in my opinion, is really worth very, very much at all.
As far as software to aid security? Do you think that there's going to be a need for new security tools inside the Linux area, better than what's out there now, or do you think that we have a good set of tools out there now?
I think we actually do have a pretty good set of tools, certainly as far as people checking to see if unexpected services are running. Nmap is a wonderful tool that I use just about every day. Nessus for doing a more in-depth analysis. Ethereal, if you want to actually analyze web traffic, works very well. And OffWatch for seeing what's going on in your network in terms of, you know, there are any systems on it that, you know, are unexpected. And I think the trend towards adaptive firewalls, certainly for perimeter defense, is a wonderful tool.
Well, with that then, hey, Jeff, how about you start talking about some adaptive firewalls?
Well, okay, but before we do jump on it with both feet, so to speak, I've got, you being the security expert you are, I've been hearing some information being touted on news channels like CNN and MSNBC and things like that, primarily dealing, the stories started coming out at about the time when this company P-TECH was being investigated for potentially hacking all of the government networks. That story came out 2 weeks ago, I'm sure you've all heard it. And that when that story broke, there was an awful lot of quote-unquote experts and pundits that were on these news shows throwing out numbers and statistics that were absolutely frightening the public. One of the statistics that really jumped into my mind was that within 4 hours of putting a server online, that server will be probed by a hacker. Is that even remotely true?
Oh, I would say be closer to an hour, to be honest.
How would they even know of the IP being turned active?
This is generating random IP addresses and hitting those. In fact, I was setting up a Apache server, a very hardened one for an application for a client. And, you know, I was doing some testing of it by probing it myself to make sure it detected being probed some, you know, an address that was not authorized to use it. And I'm watching log files. And, again, this was in the first hour of my having turned that system on. And I'm looking for, wait a second, that's not my IP address attacking it. And was this some random factor attacking it? And that was within the first hour.
Hate to butt in here, but, Kevin, apparently we have a technical problem. People on the stream are saying that they're hearing music and they can't hear us talking.
Uh-oh. Hold on.
Sorry about that, guys.
Yeah, I hope that's his music. I have Lord of the Rings in the background. I'm at a Lord of the Rings viewing party in preparation for the midnight showing.
Has that music been playing for the last 10 minutes?
Yep, should be fixed.
Okay. How much of that segment have we missed, Kevin?
Still checking.
And was this everybody? Okay, everybody in the IRC room that's listening to us, was everybody incapable of hearing the last segment? Respond back, please.
Oh, boy. Told to repeat the last 10 minutes is what I'm saying.
Wow. Not 30 minutes. Yeah, 10 minutes. Huh. Strange. Yeah, let's rewind. Oh, man. It's a tough thing to do. You know what? It's already 9 o'clock. Tell you what we're going to do. We're going to do an abbreviated segment on the book. And then we're going to have you come back in 2 weeks. and talk about the adaptive firewall, okay?
Well, two weeks is New Year's Eve. You sure you want to sign him up?
Okay, 3 weeks.
Okay, can you make it back here, Bob?
Absolutely, I'll be here.
Okay, well, let's real talk. Sorry about the problem. We didn't know it was happening. Apparently people were barely able to hear. We are going to do the last 10 minutes over again. So, Russ, it's back to you, and we're going to go over that description of the book, and again, we'll come back in a couple of weeks and talk about and repeat the adaptive server part. Because, you know, what that will actually allow me to do, and maybe this is a good thing, I perhaps can have you set up a server that we can do a real-time demonstration for the listeners. They can attempt to crack into it.
Okay.
Does that sound good?
Sounds like fun.
Okay. So we'll do that with the server part. But Russ, go ahead and rewind and start talking about the book, and then we'll do an abbreviated segment on that and end the show.
All righty. There are lots of security books out there. Why did you feel a need to write one, and what do you think you accomplished with it?
Well, I was intending to do one that, you know, will walk a system administrator and, of course, home users, whether they like or not, are administrators, step by step through what needs to be done to secure the system, starting from Chapter 2, which is quick fixes for common problems. These are problems that almost everybody has. Most are very quick and easy to fix if somebody just knows how and wants to take a little bit of time. And then walk through to more advanced issues if they want the system, you know, more secure. And yet, due to extra effort in terms of the index and different sections referencing, you know, related sections, it can be used as a reference book. If somebody says, okay, we're going to put up an Apache server now, and I know about the basic, you know, stuff of, you know, don't have unnecessary services and, you know, doing patches, you know, promptly. But I don't really need to know about Apache, you know, web servers. You can just flip through to that section, and there's everything you need in the particular area. I try to be very exhaustive in that there's really, I think I've gotten almost everything I like to think that somebody needs to worry about. And lastly, one of the biggest problems with most computer books is, like most of the folks, you know, listening, I have a whole shelf of books that I really should read. They really have useful information in them, but they're just too darn boring. And so I try to have quite a bit of humor, a lot of references to science fiction and Lord of the Rings and everything else in there. It's plenty of humor. Some of it is actually at Bill Gates' expense, which I think most Linux people particularly enjoy.
Mm. Bob, I have to ask you a favor, if you can. Do you have a volume control on the phone you're on?
Kind of in my throat. Do you need it louder or softer?
Oh, we need you to be louder.
Okay, how's this work?
That's better.
All right.
Because you were clipping before.
Okay.
So what do you think are the what do you find are the biggest issues facing Linux security today, in particular for the home user? What are the things that someone who's not a professional security person should be looking at least quickly to help shore up their system?
Well, really, the first thing is they worry about security at all. Many people don't bother, and they get a very rude awakening, often a lot faster than they might expect. Once they are aware that some security needs to be done, I think open network ports is really the first thing that people need to dive into. The default installation on just about any distribution will, you know, fire up a send mail listing on port 25 and a DNS server and a web server and NFS and all kinds of other things. And those are just an invitation for somebody to break into their system. So that's really the first they need to do. They need to arrange to be notified when there are vulnerabilities and so that they can apply patches. Yesterday, a vulnerability for, that affects almost every version of SSH was announced, and yet I suspect that most of the folks listening to the show have not yet found time to install those patches. You know, that's just a, you know, they're waiting to be attacked, really.
Oh, of course we have.
I'm sorry?
Of course we have.
It gives us something to do, you know.
We would admit to it one way or the other. But go ahead, continue.
Now the book, excuse me, the book is in its second edition, and the first edition was done about 2 years ago, as I see on your website. What have been the biggest changes that you've seen in security in the year 2000 versus the security in the year 2002?
Well, certainly the biggest news since then is that IP tables has come out as the standard firewall for Linux, and there really isn't good documentation on it. A lot of what I've seen is just rewrite of what was said before, and all that boils down to the author really saying, IP tables are a whole lot better than change, you all use it, and have fun. And really, there's a lot more to it than that in terms of, you know, when one is valuable versus another, how to use it, and most of them really basically repetition of the manual and telling somebody, well, this is how you add a rule, and, you know, they really don't give much idea on how to build, you know, what a complete set of rules might look like, or even how to debug a set of firewall rules, which is really quite non-trivial. With most programs or in areas of computers, you know, once you can send mail, your mail client's working, and once you're receiving mail, your server's working. With security, you really can't know that unless you use, you know, Nmap and other tools and actually verify that only the allowed traffic is getting through. So I cover that in a great deal of depth. I added a total of about 60 pages of IP tables. So, it really gives somebody really a great deal of knowledge in an area where most of the documentation really is pretty sparse.
I'm wondering, I know that a lot of recent distributions now during install will give you options about whether you want, you know, low security, medium security, or high security, and it seems to be phrased a bit differently and done a bit differently from one distribution to the other. Have you had a chance to look at some of these things and determine whether or not these things that they're calling security are really worthwhile? Are there major problems with this, or does it seem like it's going in the right direction?
Well, I really think that it's really more for show than anything. The important thing about security is to actually know what security is in one system, and a lot of times, you know, the show can show it and, oh no, except for medium security, I think that's okay. Unless you actually know what's being allowed and what isn't, you really don't know what your security is, and, you know, it's like, you know, with your house, you know, well, is it secure? Have you locked all the doors and windows? It's kind of like, I don't know. If you don't know if it's secure, frankly, it probably isn't. And, you know, most of the distributions don't document very thoroughly, you know, what the difference is, or in some cases, they're really not of any use. I know a friend of mine, when he did his install of his new Mandrake system, you know, back in the summer, he requested high security. Now, this is for a server system. Well, the security was real high. It didn't allow any network access, but, you know, it wasn't of any use to him.
That sounds like it would be a bit of a problem. Do you see any new issues coming inside the security field, say, in time for the third edition 2 years from now? Do you think that we're going to be seeing different sorts of security issues? Do you have any guesses on that area?
Well, I think judging by some of the things I talked about in my first edition, I've kind of gotten the edge of the wave on a few different things. And one thing I'm seeing now is now that, you know, most of the distributions have pretty good notification and updates for patches, and occasionally you know, people will know to turn off any services. The crackers are getting more clever in terms of attacking at the protocol level. You know, attacking a company switch, and you know, once they do that, then they can pretty much sniff the entire network, even though a switch is not supposed to allow somebody to do that. You know, they'll break into the system and change his IP address so that you really don't know which system is been compromised, and therefore it tends to be harder to track down. Those are some things we're seeing now, and so they require, you know, the proper tools to respond to that, which I think I've covered pretty well in the second edition.
There's a question in the IRC room to ask you about, as if you're supposed to know this, okay? Ask you about the Linux Security Modules project. Are you familiar with the project?
Security module. I'm not familiar with that particular terminology. Could it be known by something else? There's quite a few Linux security projects underway.
Yeah, we'll just have to see whether or not the IRC responds with that. Unfortunately, we have a bit of a response delay here. It's about 30 seconds between the time that we go over the air. So sometimes asking questions don't get answered quite in real time. There's another question from IRC asking if there is a current Linux firewall which meets your needs at this point. Products like Smoothwall and some of these things, is that do they seem like good things?
Frankly, no. I think it's really, the ideas to attempt it were good, but they're really, people will install and really not know what they have. And when that happens, you really don't have a viable firewall. You really have to know exactly what it's allowing and what it doesn't. And that really takes taking the effort to actually learn about the firewall capabilities and looking at the actual IP tables or IP chains rules that are set up. I was at a talk last week where somebody was talking about how easy it is to set up Smoothwall and not to, you know, belittle the product, but, you know, talking all about, you know, it can figure out what type of network card you have and all those nice things. And then I asked him, well, what services is it letting through, and what you know, data can pass between your internal network and your DMZ? And the fellow, frankly, had no idea.
IRC is now responding about the Linux Security Module Framework. Apparently, it's used by the NSA's SE Linux project to control the various objects inside of an operating system, I guess it is. Is that anything that you've dealt with? Have you dealt with the NSA Linux stuff at all?
I'm somewhat familiar with it. The basic concept has been around military computing quite a bit, and I worked on a Unix product similar to that, in that you have basically compartmentalized security. You have different levels of security. Any given user, program in execution, or file has a security classification that's typically unclassified, confidential, secret, top secret, and so forth. And the operating system goes through very great lengths to make sure you can't move from one to the other. In other words, you can't take a top secret document and copy it to unclassified directory, for example. And I know that NSA's Linux follows that model, which is quite a good model.
Okay. Well, I think that covered. Do you see a need for additional security software in the Linux field at this point, or do we have the right set of tools? Do we need something that's more user friendly, something like that, or do you think we've got about what we need?
I think that the answer is yes to both of those. For somebody that wants to take a little bit of time and learn how to use IP tables or IP chains, how to set up an adaptive firewall and so forth, those tools are extremely effective in terms of security. But I think that the whole purpose, or the whole reason we see products like Smoothwall and SUSE's firewall product, is because people want something a little bit more user-friendly.
Mm-hmm.
I just have looked at both those products, and I don't see them as being there. The problem with both of them is that they generate a set of rules that really, it's kind of like looking at the result of a compiler. You know, a compiler spits out assembly code, but it's much harder to interpret than having written it yourself. And therefore, you have a maintenance problem there. Certainly, a well-designed GUI-based firewall builder that is more specific about what's done, what's allowed, what isn't, would be quite useful.
Well, that pretty much answers most of my questions here. Jeff, do you have anything to add to this?
Not really. I'd like to put it off for a couple of weeks. What we're going to do, because of our little temporary train wreck, we're going to have our guest, and actually, if you'd like to invite someone else from the company to join you, so that you can have one person handling the server while the other person's talking, that's fine with us. But what we're going to do in about 3 weeks, maybe 4 weeks, we're going to have them back, and we're going to cover the second half of the information that we're going to cover tonight, and that's the adaptive server itself, and from your company, Fly By Day Consulting. And but in the interim, what we're going to do is take one of our auxiliary servers, unless you would rather do this on your own server, that's fine with us, and put the firewall on it, and anybody who is listening to the show, we will have the server hanging up there for anybody to try to hack. And it'll take me a week or two to come up with some prizes, but we'll throw up some prizes for anybody who can actually break through the firewall. And so we'll have some fun while we're doing the show as well. So I'm sure I can come up with some vendor T-shirts and things like that during the next week or two. So Bob, you willing to do that? Come back in a couple weeks.
Absolutely. I'll even risk one of my servers. It might get through, but we'll see how well we handle it.
Okay. Well, if you're sure, because there it's not as much of an effect as Slashdot, but we do have our own little effect here, especially when we mention the word prizes. You're going to get a lot of traffic on your server that night. But we'll go ahead and do it. But I want to give everybody a heads up. I screwed up on our calendar in show planning, and we are not going to be having a show next Tuesday night because that's Christmas Eve. And at least I'm going to be traveling that night. I don't know what the rest of the group is going to be doing. And the following Tuesday is New Year's Eve, and I'm going to be partying that night. So I don't know about the rest of you, but I'm not going to be available. But we're going to try at this very last minute to put together a show on Thursday the 26th. That's been the suggested date to do our annual year-end wrap-up and review of 2002. So watch the normal places, the Linux news websites, and of course you can come back to our website next week, and I'm sure we'll have a post up Tuesday night, by Tuesday night of next week, talking about this special show. But the year in review show is always fun because we have a lot of guests on. I'm sure we'll have Eric Raymond, Peter Salas, who knows who else will be joining us that night. We will probably have a panel of 10 to 12 people all discussing their favorite story of the year and making predictions for the upcoming year. What do you bet that two-thirds of the panel makes the prediction that 2003 is the year of Linux desktop? I sure think that's going to be the case. But we'll see. So on behalf of the entire crew here, I'd like to thank you all for listening. If you enjoy what we do here, keep in mind it is live radio, so there are train wrecks like tonight from time to time. We do our best. But if you do like what we do here, make sure that you tell your friends and tell your lugs if you're a member of the LUG Linux user group, because You are the people we're doing it for, and so the more users that are out there listening, the happier we all are to bring this show to you. And 2003 is going to be our sixth year of doing so. So, until the next show, whenever it's going to be, that's it for the Linux Show, and we'll see you next time. We're out of here.
So you have an email server, huh? Well, check out one of our sponsors. What? The Linux Show has sponsors? Yeah, well, how the hell do you think we pay the bandwidth bill around here? Well, it's really more the phone bill, not the bandwidth bill. Phone bill is killing us. But anyways, back to our sponsor. Check out the folks at www.littlebluebox.com and buy their stuff and sponsor.